Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall, and this is the Downtime Podcast, where we take you inside the world of mountain biking. First up this week, it's time to announce our winner of the Shearer Jersey competition. So Domino Mac, you're the lucky winner, and Paul from your Shearer will have been in touch, hopefully, to see what jersey you want and in what size. When you've got it, get some photos, send them over. We want to see you enjoying your new jersey. Don't forget the podcast's available in many different places. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn Radio, just to mention a few. Also, there's a brand new app called Google Podcasts that Google have created. Great for you Android users or for anyone that wants something different from iTunes or Spotify. It's pretty new, but we're on there, so download it, have a look. It might well work for you. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on whichever app you prefer and get all of the latest episodes delivered straight to your phone or your computer. You can do that, like I said, in the app, or you can do it on our website. Head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. While you're there, there's a form you can fill in to join our newsletter and keep up to date with all the podcast news. Also, give us a follow on socials. We're at Downtime Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, and at Downtime Tweets on Twitter. Now, if you follow us on social media, you'll know that I've been a very, very lucky boy, and I've got an amazing new bike. It's a Cotic Flair Max, so 29er. Short travel, first bike of that kind that I've had, and so far I've been super impressed. It's incredible. So I just want to take a minute to say thank you to everyone that's helped put that bike together. So a massive thank you to Cy at Cotic, Geordie at Fox for providing suspension, Dustin at We Are One Composites. They've sent some amazing carbon fiber wheels. Highly recommend you check them out, making wheels in Kamloops in Canada. Thanks to Ard at Kogel Bearings, who sent me a ceramic bottom bracket and some jockey wheels. This is the same stuff that the guys over at the YT Mob are using, so if it's good enough for them, it's definitely good enough for me. Cheers to Stephen at Maxxis, sent over some great tyres. I've got a Minion DHF on the front and an Aggressor on the rear. Been super impressed with those so far. Thank you to Yada at WTB for sending a saddle. Rachel at Hope for helping me out with brakes and some finishing kit. Dave at Bergtet for supporting with bars, stem, and some of their awesome penthouse flat pedals. And then also Bruce over at Mudhugger for providing me an awesome mudguard with a matching sticker. So thanks a lot for that. It's amazing. I'm stoked. And it's been fun riding. I can't wait to spend some more time on it this summer. If you want to help support the podcast, and it is only, you know, the support from you guys that helps us keep going, you can head over to downtimepodcast.com/shop and grab yourself a t-shirt. Thanks to everyone who's bought one so far. Really appreciate it. Keep sending the pictures in of yourselves wearing them. It's great to see. Okay, on to this week's guest. This week, we've got another strength and conditioning coach for you, and it's Alan Milway. I've looked up to Alan for a long time. He's been associated with some of the top people in the sport, multiple world champions. He's worked with people like the Athertons, Danny Hart, Phil Atwell, Sam Dale, Manon Carpenter. He currently works with Brendan Fairclough. And it's not just the downhill side of the sport. He's also working in enduro with people like Martin Mays and Mark Scott. So he's got a super interesting perspective, and there's loads of great insight in this episode. One of the key things for me is we talk about three things that Alan feels every rider should be doing alongside just getting out and riding your bike. So sit back, have a listen. Hope you find some interesting stuff in there. Without further ado, here's Alan Milway. Alan Milway, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you.
Good stuff. So before we get cracking with kind of your main element, which is the coaching side of things, tell us a little bit about how mountain biking came into your life.
Oh, well, I guess I'd be the sporty kid at school, really. I was the guy that the only reason I got out of bed in the morning was for PE. I played football, cricket, rugby. Ran, I did a lot of athletics, and to be honest, I just wanted to be a professional footballer or a professional golfer. Those are really that's what I was into. And then I hurt my knee, and the doctor said, you know, you should either be swimming or cycling. Those are the two best things for you. And back then I had to wear Speedos at school to go swimming. So there's no chance of that happening as a teenage boy when you had to swim with the girls and you were in your Speedos. So I was like, you know, I was into bikes. I've been bikes since probably 4 or 5, but I just, I remember it vividly. I went into WH Smith and I bought Mountain Bike International magazine in July, August of 1995, probably. And that's when Chris Porter was the editor, ironically, once of Mojo and now of Jomatron and Mojo Rising fame. He was the editor there. And that was it. I was just absolutely hooked and just to never look back. I still ride an awful lot at the moment. It really is, bikes are my passion. My wife would probably say obsession. I don't know what the difference is between passion and obsession. I'll say it's a passion, but we may differ on opinion with that.
Cool. And so how did the coaching side of things come about then? So initially it was that the riding was just a pleasure and an enjoyment side of things, right?
Yeah, that was what I was into. And I got into racing my bike. I started as a junior and I worked my way up I was elite level. I sort of graduated into the elite class, but this was before expert. So you went from senior, and if you're top 10 senior, you went into elite. And I got in, you know, I was the lower end of that top 10 and got into elite. And I think that's when I realized that my gaps were more in my technical ability than my fitness. And where I was good was in my fitness and my knowledge and understanding of it. And that's as I was going into university to study sports science. So when I came out of university, it was actually a conversation. It's weird how these things come around. So the conversation was with a guy called Paul Hunt, who organized the Pedal Hounds races, and they're sort of making a bit of a comeback now. But I'd known Paul for years, and we sat down, and I was really into my motocross at the time. I didn't really race, but I was into it. And he is an ex-European motocross champion. And he said, Alan, you know, these motocross lads will really benefit from your knowledge. There really is a gap in the sort of fitness element of motocross in Britain. So I took out an advert in Trials and Motocross News, which is obviously a newspaper that's still going. And I literally took out the smallest, cheapest advert you could. I just put this little square box in and offered my services. And 6 months later, I was writing an article for Dirt Bike Rider, a monthly article. And the first article I wrote was about arm pump. Because I was getting fed up with these kids telling me that they didn't want to do any upper body strength training because they were getting arm pump from it. And it was fascinating because, you know, I can pull my hair out if I had any, but it was more the fact that it was their lack of knowledge. And I just wanted to put something out there to say, look, guys, there is a physical manifestation. You know, it's not in your head. Obviously, there's your stress level and you riding at the front and tightening up, blah, 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 that plays a part, but it is actually a physical issue that we need to address, and it can be alleviated to a degree. So I wrote this article, and then I was approached by one of the big motocross teams, and that was really where my coaching started. I was working with a lot of the British Championship top 10 for 3 or 4 years before I was approached by a very polite young man on email called George Atherton. And you know, he'd read some of my stuff and wanted me to help him out.
So that's how the riding side came then. G had seen you, the work you were doing with the motocross teams.
Yes, exactly. That's how the downhill got into it. Back then, there was absolutely no market for downhill coaching. There was very few guys making money. There were on the World Cup circuit, but not really in the UK. I guess PT was probably PT and Warner and Longdon. Mm-hmm. Those were probably the only guys making a living. I might be missing a couple, but those were the big hitters that were making their money. But there wasn't a market to sort of open up and dream that you can make a living being a coach in mountain biking. But there was in motocross. So that's I was teaching PE alongside this. I'm a qualified PE teacher. So it all sort of dovetails together. And having worked with G, that was sort of my first link with the Athertons. But then they were working in the States. They went to the States for their winter. And I met Danny Hart in a car park in Leger. I actually met Paul Hunt. I met Paul in a car park in Leger, yeah. I wanted to borrow what did I want of him? Something for my box of forks. And Danny ran boxes when he was on his Balfa as like a 14, 15-year-old. And that's it. You know, it was just these conversations and these meetings. And I met Danny as a very young lad in Leger. And we just started a gradual, you know, that sort of coaching relationship. And I worked with him for 5 years.
Nice. All fell into play then. You found the right niche, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's it, really. I never I never imagine what I do for a living. You know, when you go in and you see the sort of job, I don't know what they even call them now, the careers advisor at school, and they're like, what do you want to do when you grow up? I was just like, I just want to be involved in bikes. And I just sort of educated myself in the area I was really passionate about, which was basically human fatigue. Why do we get tired? That's my interest. I'm very physiology led. So I just educated myself at a degree level to that. And I did a sport and material science degree. And it was only when, things sort of opened up and I was in the right, whether I was in the right place at the right time. Yeah, maybe I was, but it was all I could imagine myself doing.
Yeah, interesting. And you've coached some pretty big names since then. Give us a bit of a feel for some of the people that you've worked with.
It's a bit of a laundry list, I'm afraid. I worked with the Saracen team. So Manon, I met Manon when she was 18, and just, it was at Chompre I met Manon. So her graduation sort of from junior up to elite, and worked with Simmons and Phil Atwell and Sandale on the Saracen team. And then from there, I sort of moved to work for the Athertons. So all of those guys, obviously Dan, Jim Rach and Taylor Vernon and Martin Mays, which was brilliant. Worked with them for a good while. But then there's the sort of enduro side as well with Mark Scott and Joe Barnes, a number of other enduro boys. And I guess I could go on. Now I'm working with Brendan and Joe Breeden and Lachlan, and really I've got a good focus on the international races, but also the amateur guys. So yeah, I've been around a little while now.
Nice. Yeah, it's an amazing list of people. So when you meet one of these athletes for the first time, or meet a client for the first time, I'm interested in what kind of assessment you do to understand their gaps or weaknesses or imbalances, and also whether that's something that us mere mortals can do kind of at home or in the gym to understand what kind of stuff we need to be working on.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because in all honesty, what you've just said is one of the reasons that I don't like to just write programs for people if I haven't seen them. I'm not one of the coaches that sort of writes online training programs, and I really try and bring everyone I see down to the University of Birmingham, which is where I work. Or I'll go up. I travel to Fort William to see, you know, all the guys who are based up there so essentially this exact reason. And if someone comes to me for the first time, and a good way of describing it is, Brendan's probably quite a good example of this, because when I met Brendan, he'd been doing a lot of training, but he'd actually had an ACL injury, and he felt as though, you know, oh, I'm okay, the knee's okay, there's no soreness, there's no pain. But once you sort of drill down into some of the movements we did, you could actually see where the difference lay. And for me, I try and see someone for a day, and we'll split that into two. So it will be two sessions. One will be in the lab, so we actually look at them on a bike and we look at the physiology and their sort of makeup, where they are now with their fitness. But then I also will have them in a gym, and that's not necessarily to throw a load of weight around. It's more to see them move. And I learn probably more from that gym session, that sort of 90 minutes, 2 hours, than I could possibly learn through any number of video clips or emails back and forth, because it's where we understand. As an example, if you've had a previously broken ankle, for example, we may see that your dorsiflexion, your ability to sort of flex the knee forward in front of the toes is very limited. And someone might say, oh, I'm fine. But you get them to do some calf raises, left versus right. And normally the numbers speak for themselves. They jump out at you, these differences. I had a BMX lad who I worked with, and funnily, I saw him this morning, and he had a knee to wall test of 0 centimeters. So he couldn't get his knee in front of his toes with his heel on the floor, which is, and we look at functional movement to be about 8 centimeters. So when you put that into perspective, it really is a huge limitation for a sort of fundamental movement pattern, a squatting pattern, a lunge walk pattern. Anything like this is really hindered by that. So what I want to do is build up this picture of somebody to understand, is there actually something that's holding them back? Because if that's the case, the biggest bang for the buck is to try and help that and alleviate that and get some level between left side and right side. So if, and that really doesn't matter whether you're an international full-time professional athlete or you're someone who works at a desk 9 to 5 and you just enjoy riding your bike at the weekend. If you've got an issue that is limiting you, you know, trying to unpick that and improve that and strengthen what is essentially a weakness or a tightness or a limitation, that's where you'll make the biggest difference.
Yeah. And clearly there's, you know, there's huge benefits from doing something like that with a trained practitioner. But are there any basic level assessments that, you know, us mere mortals can do at home and use that to understand whether there's certain things we could be doing to improve our bodies?
Yeah, sure. There's, I guess, a couple of easy ones that sort of come out that are relatively easy to describe would be if you were to, you can do it into a mirror or sort of, you wouldn't need a mirror to guide you on this, but simply stand on one leg, lift the other knee up. So it's sort of horizontal, your thigh's horizontal, and just do 2 or 3 hops on one leg and try and control the landing, and then just walk back and repeat on the other side. And you may find that actually, if you've had a previous injury or one glute really isn't doing the job it should be, you'll find there's actually a big difference in terms of your ability to control that landing. And you can also follow that up with simply some calf raises. I do calf raises to max, to a tempo. So it's sort of a 60 BPM. You can put that, you can just Google, Google will bring up this metronome and you can just put it to 60. And you literally go up and down to the metronome and just repeat, repeat, repeat until you can't do any more, or your knee starts to cave in slightly and you start to try and pull yourself up. And that will give you quite a nice idea in terms of your lower limb, if there is a difference left to right there. There's plenty of others with single leg glute bridge raises, and I could go on and split squats, etc. But I think that for me, I get a good idea if I have someone lunge walk. I see if one knee's trying to fold in, whether the heel's creeping off the floor. And then I'll follow that up with some hop controlled landings. And then I'll follow that up with some calf raises. So that's the lower limb. And in terms of upper limb, one thing that I like to do is a supine pull. You can do this in a squat rack. You just put the bar into the rack, sort of at the height that you'd bench press from, and remove any bench so it's out of the way. And you're literally lying under that. It's almost like a reverse bench press. You put your feet flat on the floor and you try and pull your chest to the bar. Some people actually are that tight that they can't get their chest to touch the bar. So that's your first, that's a real red flag. You know, you're like, okay, we've got some limitation here. We need to work on your mobility to bring those shoulder blades back towards each other. But you can also do a max rep effort, and then you can compare that to a max press up effort. So immediately you've got a pull and a push, and you're trying to understand if there's a difference in the ratio between them. And for a lot of people, there's a big difference. A lot of mountain bikers are much better at pulling than they are pushing, in my experience, and that sort of shows them that quite easily. And really, that's all I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to throw my opinion onto anyone very strongly. I'm just trying to open them up, open their eyes to some of their strengths and weaknesses, and from that, I think it helps with their buy-in, because if they understand why I'm asking them to do a certain movement, they'll go, I see, he's asking me to a single leg movement because my left leg's much weaker than my right. You know, we can actually, they're on the same page.
All right, just a quick interlude from me. If you're enjoying listening to what Alan has to say, but you've got some questions, you can ask him in the week following the podcast launch over in our Facebook group. It's a closed group, so you do need to request to join. Just head to Facebook and do the group search and look for MTB Performance Tips and Tricks. Or there'll be a link in the show notes so you can join from there. Alan will be taking questions and doing his best to answer from the launch of this episode until the Friday of the week that it comes out. So get signed up, join the group and get involved.
So if, for example, we do one of these assessments on ourselves and we find that hopping on one leg is way more challenging than the other, is it a case that there's a simple one or two exercises that you do to remedy that, or do you need someone who understands the detail of what's going on in order to kind of help program relevant exercises to fix your specific issues. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that to a certain extent, it's the understanding. If there's something that's really, really tight, if somebody's really tight in their ankle, for example, if they've had this ankle injury and they've not really rehabbed from it, they'll find that it's challenging to land in a controlled manner on one leg. And it might be that it's not so much the strength that's an issue, it's the actual the movement in that joint. And okay. It could be that simple stretching mobility movements will address that, or it may be that you actually need to go to see a physiotherapist, you know, to have that sort of manipulation and further input. But I work very closely with the physiotherapist at the uni. Is literally two doors from the gym, so it really does dovetail very nicely. And will often on Thursday I had Joe Breeden and a professional motocross rider called Luke Norris. They were both in, and they've both got various ailments, and they'll have half an hour, 40 minutes with the physio, and then the physio comes in with the athlete to go, right, this is what we found, this is what we need to address, more on this, less on that, and that's ideal. But from if you've done this, if say you've done some controlled landings and you found that actually I really struggle on my left leg and actually my calf is very much weaker on the left-hand side, it as a simple starting point, do more exercise without your shoes on, lunge, split that, just lunge walk, split squats, actually activate, have one leg unilateral exercises. That will, for many people, close this gap very closely, because a lot of people will walk in the gym, they'll try to deadlift, they'll try to squat, they'll leg press, and then they'll work on their biceps. And actually, yeah, you know, that's not ever going to get to the bottom of this problem. And that's really why, for me, if I'm writing a training plan, I've got to decide, right, what am I trying to get from this training plan? Because if I'm looking to really improve max strength and max power, this doesn't fit into that mold. Can you see it? It doesn't, you know, it's sort of trying to do something very different. So I try and address these things towards the end of one season or in the off season, so that we're really fresh, and by the time we got to January, we've tried to iron these things out as much as possible to within what we consider a good, safe, manageable range, whether that be, for me, it's sort of well within 20%, ideally within 15%. And then we keep an eye on them and maybe do a bit more volume on that weaker side. There'll always be a weaker side. It's very rare to get someone who's completely symmetrical, especially if they bang themselves up, you know.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. So mountain biking, and I guess cycling in general, it's quite a specific body position and a repetitive action in the legs. Are there common issues that mountain bikers tend to have in kind of tightness or posture or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I often see in the guys that come to me some similar symptoms or issues, should we say. And I think that the one of them is certainly tight hip flexors, the position you're on a bike, being seated for a lot of the time, driving in a van, at a desk, on the plane, it often leads to being very tight in the hips, and the hip flexors, due to their sort of insertion in the lower back, can actually lead to quite a sore lower back. So I certainly try and remedy that. And also the position we're on, unfortunately, in daily life, being at phones, at desks, driving, means that we get quite tight in the pec, which limits our ability to get our arms overhead. And we sometimes have to compensate to get our arms overhead due to sort of tightness in the shoulders. And for me, that's also an issue if you come off your bike, because we want really nice mobility. If you imagine putting your hand out in front of you to stop yourself in a crash, and we go beyond that point, if we're really tight and knotted up in our shoulders and our posture's not good, we're just at a higher injury risk. So that's one reason why I'd like to have people achieve some quite fundamental movement patterns and see them in overhead squat, and actually make them move in ways that you might initially look at and go, well, how's that helping me on a bike? But it's for that reason, really.
Okay. So maybe working with those two things, tight hip flexors is certainly something that I suffer from. Are there any kind of specific movements or exercises that help alleviate that?
Yeah, I guess the easiest one and the most immediately felt one is imagine sort of standing in front of your, if you just stand up off your sofa, imagine you're sitting on a sofa, you just stand up off your sofa, take a step forward and just hook your right foot, the toes of your right foot onto the edge of the sofa, and then drop the knee of that right foot to the base of the sofa. You'll sort of find yourself in a half kneeling position, sort of a lunge position. And if you just try and maintain a nice upright torso, look ahead of you, and then just gradually tighten your bum and push your hips forwards, you'll really feel that in the right hand, anywhere from the top of the hip all the way down the quad. And that really is a nice stretch. It's, you know, Kelly Sturat was really a big fan of that sort of the mobility wad, CrossFit. He's a good guy from CrossFit, and that certainly came to my attention a long time ago from something he said. And I was like, oh, that's a really nice way to drill down to it. And also there's a few yoga moves that are very similar to that. And then if you're looking at sort of pecs and upper body, for me, I like to do, whether you call it, I call it an arm sweep, however you want to call it. Imagine you're lying on your side as if I call it a sleeping position. So you're sort of on your side, knees are one on top of each other. You're sort of turned away from the wife if you had an argument, or turned towards her because you're having a good night, one or the other. And I just think about if you're lying on your left-hand side, just keeping the fingertips of the right hand on the floor, just form a nice arc above your head and just open yourself up. Just form a nice trace around your head and try and really draw the arm around sort of a big semicircle over your head whilst keeping your knees firmly planted on the floor. Now that's great for everything down the back, but for most people they'll feel it in the pec because they're so tight there, and feel it in the shoulder. So there are many others, and obviously getting a ball into the armpit will help really get into some of those tight spots. And various other movements for the pec, but those are two of my favorites.
Yeah, and is that something that we should be doing kind of fairly regularly as cyclists? Because I'm guessing even if you've worked to loosen up those muscles, spending time on a bike's gonna sort of help them tighten back up again, right?
Yeah, I can't remember where I read it or who I was speaking to about it, but I was having some debate about this, and we reckon that you needed, you know, sort of 5 minutes for every hour you're on the bike to sort of work on those hip flexors and some of these postural issues. So I think that's probably, you know, good advice. And it's certainly something I say to my guys. If you've been out on the road bike for two and a half hours, you know, you should definitely spend 5-10 minutes afterwards or that evening, you know, on the foam roller and loosening up the back and loosening up the hip flexors and addressing some of these things, because all what happens, and I see it time and time again in all the years I've been doing this, is you'll really be conscientious about these things when you've got your training head on. But when the season comes around and you're doing a lot of traveling and a lot of racing and you're not in the gym as much, you often, it's really easy to sort of forget these things. And 3 weeks later, Alan, my back's a bit tight, you know, I'm feeling a bit sore. And I'm like, well, have you been doing X, Y, and Z? And they're like, oh, I haven't really. And trying to make it part of your daily routine, it sounds so cliche, but it really does make a difference if you can.
Yeah, so keeping mobility and flexibility kind of forefront.
Definitely, yeah, definitely. You'll have, for me, I love strength and I'm a big fan of strength, and I can give you all these numbers about where I think you should be in terms of your strength levels. But if you've got a sore back and it's not allowing you to be out on your bike and enjoy your bike and deliver all that strength and power, you know, you're no good. So you need a good starting point, and sometimes it's this remedial work that actually keeps the pro athlete on the track more than squatting 160 kilos, 150 kilos or deadlifting over 200. You know, that's, for me, we've got to have it all in perspective.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you actually, what if, assuming, you know, riding a bike is, we're all going to do that anyway, what three things on top of going riding should everyone be doing every week? And I'm guessing we've probably just hit the first one there.
Yeah, absolutely. Some mobility, just understand where your tightness lies. If you lie on your back, leg straight out in front of you, and you just hook a towel around your foot and you just draw one leg up, keeping it straight above you, if you can't get it anywhere near, we look at sort of a point, I've got a datum point where in line with the knee, in line with the mid femur, or in line with the hip. If you're really tight, in both hamstrings, you really need to address that. Cyclists generally are. You might find one side's much tighter than the other. I have one side tighter than the other due to a hip. I've got a bit of a twisted hip, sort of congenital issue. It means I've got one leg slightly longer than the other. So I've got to manage that. So mobility is definitely one. Some form of strength training I think is really important because it allows you to deliver power on the bike. So a lot of people might be able to sit at 400 watts for, you know, a few minutes or whatever, and they can push on hard, but they've got a real glass ceiling to their power output. And you'll really notice the difference in your acceleration out corners, in your ability to control landings, if you have more strength. And in terms of upper body, it's one of these things that you won't realize how useful your upper body strength is until you need it. So you overjump something to flat, you haven't got the upper body strength, you'll crumple on the bars, you'll dislocate your shoulder, and you'll put it down to a bad landing. You won't put it down to being weak as a kitten. And that is one thing that I've tried to get through to some of the motocross riders, because I've seen some of the crashes they've had, and some of them, yeah, they're horrendous, but some of them I thought, God, if you just were able to hold your chest off the bars, you might have saved that. There's quite a good clip to understand this and really put into perspective, and it's Rach Atherton in Haffiel. She was coming out of the last section of woods. Have you been there before? Have you been to that track?
No, I haven't.
It's a great track. It's got a mix of everything. And right near the bottom, before the sort of sweeping corners where Josh launched to the moon over that last bridge, yeah, you come out of the woods and it's really rocky. It's where Sam Hill crashed in his world's run. And just as you come out of there, Rach got it. She was coming out at a rate of knots, and she just sort of collapsed over the front of the bars, just got it, the timing a bit wrong. And she was just able to hold herself up and sort of literally press herself away from the bars and carry on. And that's it. You know, there's the race run or no race run. And you could have worked, you know, you could have worked for 8 months for that quarter of a second of your race run. And yeah, it's made the difference potentially for your race run, potentially for your season, because if you come off, you've got an injury. If you haven't come off, you haven't got an injury. So for me, strength is vital. And the third aspect, and this might sound really counterintuitive, but bear with me, is to actually do some riding at very low intensity.
Okay.
It's not sexy. It's not something that Men's Health will have you believe in, because they're all about high intensity stuff. But it's very, very hard to develop aerobic capacity at high intensities. Okay. The mitochondria do not increase in density when you are at high effort levels, high heart rates, high lactate levels. We need to have low lactate levels, low heart rates, and that's where we really build our engine. So you need this sort of foundation within you to allow you to move on a level. I'm a big fan of a submax test, which doesn't give you that VO2 max figure, which is what everyone wants to talk about, but it helps you understand the engine of the athlete. And for many, many people I work with, they don't have this low end. And that's why if you look at Olympic sports, they generally have this sort of 80-20 rule, where 80% of their time they're very steady, very repeatable, very easy levels of effort. And then the 20% of the time they're going balls to the wall. And for a mountain biker, if you look at their week, I bet you any money, it's almost the flip side. You know, whenever they're out on the bike, they're going, right, I've got an hour and a half, let's go. Or let's go to the gym and smash a CrossFit circuit. It just isn't proportional. And it's something that I spend a lot of time discussing, debating, visiting, learning from other sports, other coaches. And that's where you know, it really takes you out of that, your little bubble, and you go, you know what? Maybe it's just a sort of a confirmed hunch or confirmed knowledge that you've got to go, yeah, I do need to stick to my guns on this. It's not what everyone's putting on their Instagram, but it does make sense. So, okay. Yeah.
And that for enduro and downhill athletes, that sort of session?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could get into the nitty gritty of when you program it and different times of year and different proportions and lengths. But ultimately, I think that if you're listening to this podcast and you're reflecting on what you've done in the week, and you find that all your rides are a certain intensity, they've all got a similar pattern to them, you might end up being in this sort of no man's land of training, where it's not really hard enough for a race intensity, which is a very valid way to train, you know, to really go hard for short periods of time, hence the sort of interval training and HIIT, etc. But then it's not really developing some of these things that will allow you to burst through your sort of current ceiling level of performance. And having improved aerobic capacity just means you're able to sit at a higher wattage before lactate builds and before you start to fatigue. So as a really good example, I was coaching one of my enduro mountain bike guys this morning, and when he came to me in the winter, he was able to sit at 140 beats a minute, it was for him, which is about 2 millimoles. And we don't need to worry about the science really at the minute, but say 140 beats a minute, he was at 220 watts. We put a program in place for him and we've retested him, and he's now at the same effort level, he's able to sit at nearly 280 watts. Now, 280 Whoa. Watts is incredible. But if you think that guy can sit there all day long up a climb without really feeling much, you know, he'll do that for hours. And that's, yeah. you know, that's class levels of fitness, that is. So and that's because we haven't just smashed him apart. You know, we've looked to improve this ceiling height to give him more room to grow, really. So it's understanding the full picture of what fitness is and what yeah. fitness is for your discipline.
Yeah, that's awesome. So what would a session like that look like? These kind of, I mean, how low are you doing it, based on heart rates or powers or?
You can do it on either. I have spent quite a bit of time on training camps, you know, in different parts of the world and with different sorts of athletes. And I remember talking to Javier Gomez's coach. Javier Gomez is a triathlete who he sort of split the Brownlee brothers at the last Olympics. He's an incredible athlete. And I was chatting to his coach about this, exactly this question, how do they program? And they do it all based on heart rate. They don't worry about wattage at all. And you can have a ceiling height on wattage, but for me, I call it a rev limited session, and I'll set their rev limit based on where their 2 millimoles is, and I'll keep them underneath that. And generally, if you want a number, it will generally be under 140 beats a minute. This may vary from person to person, and some people will actually be above this and some people will be way below this. So it's not really a recovery session. You know, it's not that sort of turning your legs over to try and get some life back in you and 40 minutes sort of coffee ride. It's a, you know, you can go out for 90 minutes, 2 hours, but you're not getting sucked into what I call a no man's land. I want you to understand why you're doing this session. It should feel easy. You should come home without really breaking a sweat and go, Alan, that wasn't really very hard. And if that's my feedback, I'm happy.
Oh, and are we talking about, that's probably around 65, 70% max heart rate, roughly? Is that feel about right? Is that high?
Yeah, it probably wouldn't reach 75% max heart rate. It'd be underneath that.
Okay. Yeah. So it's around the 60, 70 max sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, I'd say okay. so. To yeah, be honest, it's the way I look at it isn't based on a percentage of max heart rate. It's based on where their turn point is in terms of their lactate accumulation. So I look at it from a slightly different way, and people will accumulate different intensities based on their fitness level. Some people are able to sit at quite a high percentage without really accumulating anything. It should feel, if we look at it on I think a better way to look at it is actually not on heart rate, but your rate of perceived exertion. So you get this Borg scale. And if you imagine the very lowest end, sort of 7, 8, 9 is watching Netflix. Okay. You're doing nothing. There's really no effort level involved. Up to 13 is just starting, sort of 13 starting to get a little bit hard. And then it goes up to sort of 20 where you couldn't bear to do another second. It should really feel under 13. It should be really quite manageable. If you were to sort of give it a comment in your head, it should feel fairly easy. For most people, because I ask them this, I'll show them a sheet on a clipboard that will have this perceived exertion scale on it. So for every stage they do of this test, they'll just point to how they feel. And for most people, it's fairly easy. It's fairly light.
So probably feel quite dull, I guess, as a ride. You're not pushing,
you know, you're literally just exactly that away. It's and this is one of the reasons why it's so hard. It's actually quite hard to do, because it doesn't feel difficult. It doesn't necessarily feel as though you're doing anything. And that's one of the reasons, from a coaching point of view, you can often you can often think, God, is this really the right thing to do? Because it's certainly no entertainment, you know. And I've got to, some people, you have to think, am I here to, they want to be entertained. They want to go, that was a cool session, or I've done really well, I feel really good. And it is quite hard to go, you know what, I'm not here to entertain you. I'm here to make you fitter. You'll be entertained by standing on that podium. That, for me, is your entertainment. You know, that's where you'll feel as though the hard work has been worth it. But it isn't always hard work. And I sort of reflect back to watching a rower. I went down to see the GB team for some coaching they were doing with their rowers. And this girl came in. She wasn't on the full squad. She was just underneath the sort of performance level. So she wasn't fully funded, and she'd been to work in the morning, and she'd come in to join the Helen Glovers and the, you know, the top elite women for that session. And she got on the rowing machine, she put her headphones on, and she was rowing for 20,000 meters, and she was rowing at 2 millimole. It was just super easy. It was super dull. And I'm thinking, that poor girl, that is a grind. You know, it's not, she was hardly breaking a sweat, but that's where you, it's where you make your money. You know, it's where you make the difference. So ultimately, it's got to boil down to, does it actually make a difference?
Yeah. So a good training plan, then, it shouldn't just be about smashing yourself on the bike or in the gym. It needs to have a balance, and I guess also needs to have some really good rest and recovery built in.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. It really does. And that's why I think from a coach's point of view, I've got to understand the race season. I've got to understand the demands of the racing. Because if someone's gone away and said, I had a race weekend, and I said, you know, how did it go? And they said, yeah, it was easy, it was fine. That isn't really appropriate feedback, because those guys, these guys are next level, what they consider hard or what they consider painful. You know, I need to understand that. And I've actually been doing a lot of work with my physio recently on helping her understand what these guys go through, because they don't feel pain like normal feel pain. You know, people, it's really incredible to witness what these guys consider to be easy. So from a coaching point of view, yeah, I had an easy session. I've had power cranks on G's bike when he's had a fun day out at Riola. You know, and he's done, like, basically he's done 10 sprint intervals within a huge level, and I'd done 6 sprint intervals that morning. And so he then said to me 2 days later, he's feeling quite tired. And I was trying to work out where this came from. And that's why I decided I'm going to have power cranks on the bikes just to get a feel for what they consider an afternoon of uplifting. And that's when it really came to, you know, really showed me, whoa, I didn't need to do my morning session, because all I've done is make him tired. I just need to guide what he's doing on the downhill bike a bit more. So he has his, you know, technical input, but I've also got an input from a sort of a training standpoint, and then you dovetail them together and don't end up flogging them to death, really.
Yeah, I think people underestimate how hard a fun mountain bike ride is, because you are generally, you know, you're sprinting into stuff to be hitting it fast and enjoying it. You're pedaling back up the hills. Even what maybe we consider, you know, just going out on the bike is actually pretty tiring on the body, and maybe we're not giving ourselves enough rest.
I really think that's the case. And if you think that you're trying to, you know, you're trying to really hit those high points for a downhiller, if you're you know, if you're testing, maybe you're against the clock. I try and do a lot of stuff against the clock now. I've got 3 lap time in poles, and I take my juniors out quite a lot to work on this sort of from a technical standpoint. But also help them understand from a timing standpoint, how hard is hard? You know, what is a flat out run? What is a cruiser? What does that look like on the stopwatch? So they start to understand, you know, potentially why they're feeling tired. Because if they've done 6 runs and they've been hard runs, I don't need to try and replicate that the next day. They've done that. I need to prepare them for the next time they do that. And that might actually be from giving them some more rest and improving their strength, so they're able to control that bike and push on that bit harder. Because that's generally what you see, that the strength. I remember hearing something really interesting from the Fox guys when I was on a good few of the Fox testing camps, and they were saying that a lot of the girl suspension was set at very similar levels, and a lot of the boys' suspension was set at very similar levels, apart from Rach and apart from Gwynny. And those two really had a step up in their pressures and their compressions. and they were just riding stuff that bit harder. And I think that's really interesting to reflect on and sort of think these guys are, you know, they're riding hard and they're using that strength they've got to really push the bike that bit harder.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, everyone for a long time, I guess, has said that Gwyn rides his bike pretty stiff, but you can see it. You can watch him on a track, and it's not dropping through the travel as much as some of the other guys out there. So he's obviously relying on some strength there.
Oh, absolutely. And the momentum, if you watch the Croatia, the first round, he won the race, in my opinion, on one corner. There was a really near the top. You had the jumps at the top. You came across like a knockdown rock wall. It was like a dry stone wall, essentially. Then you had a little shimmy off camber through some trees, and then you came over another dry stone wall, and it was a long left hander into a long right hander, and that right hander was really blown out and holy. And then you had to carry a load of speed over this traverse into like a little chicane before the drop where Brooke went down, and the camera picks him up. The camera sort of zooms in on him, and he carried, I don't know in terms of speed, in terms of miles an hour, but he probably carried in 3 or 4 miles an hour more than anyone else into that section. And he was able to keep it out of that section. And he made all his time there, and he nearly threw it away at the bottom of the course on the easiest bit. He didn't get that bridge very good. You know, he didn't get over the bridge very well. He wasn't very good onto that bottom pavement section and lost time there. But because he'd really nailed that bit, and he was fascinating, and I listened to your podcast with him. He's an interesting guy, really polite guy. I wouldn't say we're friends, we know each other very well, but I'll certainly say hi to him. And he's a really nice, down to earth bloke. And, you know, I think his attitude's fantastic. He knows where he feels he can win, and I think he focuses on that. And that's what I think these real great champions, him and I think Sam Hill's very much the same. He knows where he'll make his time, and then, you know, where to mitigate the losses, sort of thing.
Yeah. And do you think it's his kind of strength and conditioning element that's helping a lot? Because I know he enjoys being in the gym. He gets off on that side of the sport.
Yeah, it absolutely plays a part. I think it's to me, that's why downhill is such an incredible sport, and I love it, is because it's a jigsaw puzzle. There's lots of different elements to this jigsaw puzzle. And, you know, if you were the fittest guy in the world and your bike handling wasn't up to scratch, then who cares? If your bike handling skill is incredible, but, you know, you blow up halfway down the track and you make all your mistakes at the bottom, then you're never going to show yourself. If your bike setup's rubbish, or you've got a really bad bike, and I hate to say it, but there are good bikes on the circuit and there are bad bikes. There are a lot of good bikes, but there are also some bikes that just aren't up to scratch on the downhill circuit. And, you know, you do see that. And the top guys, you know, the Mondrake is clearly a very good bike. And understanding how to set these bikes up, is important, and they need to know how do they get the most from it, because they're not looking for a smooth ride. You know, it's really interesting chatting to, like, Brendan and G have both said this to me, that at the end of the season, when they say they race the final World Cup or they race World Champs and they put the bike in the shed for a couple of weeks or whatever, and they'll lead a normal life for a bit, and then someone will go, oh, let's go at Revo, or let's go and ride some downhill. They get the bike out of the shed and go up there. They say it's impossible to ride. They go, this is impossible to it's so hard and aggressive. It needs to be ridden fast to get the most out from it. And that's why I think for a lot of people, they need to learn how to set up the bike for them. I'm doing much more of that with the plus three guys. And, you know, people don't know how to set their bikes up, and they just can't get the most from it. So and if you're an amateur rider with limited technical ability, if you've got a bike that's working against you, you're in trouble. So you scale that up to a professional level where, I worked out that if Brendan was 2% faster, he would have been in fourth place at Fort William, which is just incredible, you know. And it's just amazing. I mean, he didn't have the great run, and it's not a case of saying, oh, I shoulda, woulda, coulda. It's just highlighting, look, these guys are all racing, so, you know, this fine lines.
Yeah, everything's got to be bang on, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
So you talked about quite a lot of measurements, data points, I guess, over the last half an hour or so. And obviously, you know, in a lab environment, you can measure all sorts of stuff, and I'm sure you've got some interesting things that you measure with the riders. But for us at home, are there certain things that we should be or could be measuring and looking at over the course of a training program or a season that are relatively easy to get hold of but are useful to us?
Yes, that's the short answer. I'm just trying to think of the best examples. I think for me, I would have certain challenges. I think that's probably I use the word challenge for some of the exercises and sessions we do with my guys, because I want them to refer back to them and see where they're at. So a fun one that we do is a 4-minute press-up challenge. So how many press-ups can you do in 4 minutes? Now, it's not scientific in terms of like, I want you to do this percentage or whatever. I just want you to go out and see how many you can do, because you can't do 4 minutes flat out of press-ups. You know, you have to, you have to understand where I need to rest. What's your strategy? How's it going to be? And it's actually really applicable from a strength endurance point of view, because for me, it's not just dreamt up out of nowhere, because generally a mountain bike downhill race is between 3 and 5 minutes. So this is just putting you bang in the middle and saying, right, let's see what we can do. And I think that it's really fun for people to compare that on an amateur level. And we always get the mechanics wanting to join in with that. That's a really fun one for everyone to do. But also to understand the link between strength and that strength endurance, but also understanding how, if I've worked on a lot of loading, a lot of volume for the upper body, so say you're doing a lot of weighted dips, or you're doing a lot of press-ups, or you're doing a lot of throwing, or you're doing a lot of bench press, how does that relate back to that 4-minute press-up challenge? So that's just, you know, off the top of my head. Another one that I think is really useful is to have a hill that I'm not a fan of Strava, but I understand why you would use Strava for this. And I think that having a stretch of hill that is just the balls to the wall, bottom to top, how long does it take me to get up there? Do that, go away, spend 6 weeks trying to improve your fitness, come back, try it again. Has it improved? Has it changed? And again, for me, I've got I can think of 2 or 3 test tracks, downhill test tracks that I use against a stopwatch, different bikes, different setups, different conditions. I can tell you what my times are for all of them. And ultimately, that's the most important one. You know, I think that if you're trying to improve your performance on a bike, let's actually challenge your performance on a bike. Let's see what's making a difference. And for a lot of people, improving their strength and improving their recovery link really closely to those run times. So I you can throw in 1 RM, like max rep bench presses or squats or deadlifts or chin ups. There's many different ways of quantifying strength that I use, but ultimately I think it's why are we training? So if you're training to be healthier and more injury free and a bit more robust, have an appropriate test for that. You know, don't test yourself on a max deadlift if you've just been trying to get a nice healthy back with some light single leg glute bridges, because they don't correlate. You know, you're just going to hurt yourself. And I'm not a big fan of throwing a lot of really heavyweight stuff at amateurs. I just prefer them to move better. And that's why I think that having, like you're saying with these testing, just go back to those simple movement patterns, go back to those calf raises, go back to some press-ups, go back to some supine pulls. Has it improved? Has it changed? And that's really quite a nice way to see if the work you've been putting in is actually relevant.
Yeah, so just recording like a benchmark at the start of a chunk of training and then coming back
absolutely
to something you know you can repeat, like a particular track or a particular exercise in a time period, so that you've got that. Yeah, you've got that measurement, I guess.
Yeah, you've got that measurement. And I think that's for me, a really important thing to do. And I think it helps in motivation. It also helps keep everyone accountable, because if someone's been sticking to a plan, we do some rowing challenges. I do some watt bike challenges, you know, with sort of 500 meter times or max wattage on the watt bike. And all of these things are to go, well, if we're trying to improve that, let's actually try and improve it and not just train for training's sake.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. All right. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time. We've got our 3 questions that we asked to everybody. So we're going to hit you up with those. The first of those is, if our listeners had £100 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they do with that £100?
I've been thinking about these. I really liked listening to your other podcasts and sort of listen to what people said for these. For me, if I had £100 or if I was advising someone how to spend £100, I really would say I would pay for some expert advice. And the reason for that is that I think that taking advice is quite hard to do. And I think that if you approach somebody who you really trust, and I'm not just talking about coaching, you know, by any stretch of the imagination, I try and identify an area that you think that you're lacking in understanding, and then really try and find somebody who you would believe and you would trust to help you with that. I really think that's the best, you know, money well spent. You know, whether that be a physiotherapist for an assessment, whether that be for a scan because you've got a niggling knee injury that's still not gone away, whether that be for some bike setup, whether that be for some coaching, skills coaching, I think would be invaluable. And I wish that I'd done that back in the day. You know, I think that I may have prolonged my career if I'd fixed some fundamental issues that I had in my technique 15 years ago. Expert advice, I think.
Yeah, that's cool. I like the breadth of that, the option to go in a direction where you think you'll benefit most.
Yeah.
It's a good answer. All right, cool. So if you could wind the clock back and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
I'd say, keep going, mate. You'll get the job of your dreams. I wouldn't change the thing. I can't believe this is the way I make my living and pay my mortgage. It's hard work. It's difficult traveling and going away from your family, but I wouldn't want to be doing anything else. So yeah, I'd just say, keep going, mate. Don't cash your chips in early.
Were you ever kind of tempted to come off of a path that you were on, or were you already quite focused by that age of where you're heading?
I think that third year of university was really difficult because a lot of my friends were applying to do like graduate jobs. And it's really like, honestly, there'll be some guys listening to this who went into those graduate jobs and they'll be like, Mil, you bugger. I can't believe it. You know, because they were like, yeah, that someone's going to pay me 30 grand to do this and wear a suit and all the rest of it. And they just went for it. And I know it, there was a big temptation, I think, from my parents as well. And from everyone, they're like, what are you going to do now? And I was like, I'm going to have a season in the Alps and then come back and do some PE teaching. They're like, I can't believe this. But, you know, I think that I wanted to earn a living doing it. I didn't want to, you know, be a gypsy about it and not just postpone work. Don't get me wrong. I really wanted to, you know, focus on improving what I was doing and going down that road. And for me, I think that has paid off. And I really would encourage anybody, if you've got something you like to do, I can't emphasize it. I'm trying to teach my daughter this, like whatever she wants to do and she enjoys, let's go for it, let's give it a go, let's try it out, let's see how we get on, because I think that there's no better job in the world than the job you enjoy doing.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great attitude to have. Not always the easiest route, but definitely the best one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, cool. And then the final question, although I've got one more that I might add, if you could have a coaching session from anyone, who would it be, why, and what would you want to learn?
Well, I told you this before, and it took me about half a second to come up with the answer for this. It would be Nico Vulios. I'm sure it's a popular answer, but when I was growing up, he was like, him and PT were doing battle. He was like the straight-laced Frenchman, and everyone said he was boring, and he went to bed at 10. And for me, I thought that's brilliant. You know, you want to win. You're going about, you want to do everything possible to beat these guys. And he had the last laugh. What was it, 11 World Championships?
It's insane.
Yeah. And I like that. I think Burrell's cut from the same cloth. I don't know Fabian, you know, but I think I'd love to spend more time with Fabian, understand his thoughts on things, because he's a clever guy and he's astute. And for me, what they've done is they've tried to understand the problem that they're trying to solve. And then they've gone about trying to solve that problem. And I think that's brilliant. So to spend some time with Nico, and I'd love to be coached by him. I think that you can see in Adrian Daly, the enduro rider, I think he's been taken under Nico's wing. And I think you can see that. It would be Nico.
Is there a particular element of riding or racing that you'd really want? If you only had an hour with him, like, is there something you would want to focus on?
Yeah, it'd be my cornering. Between the corners, I'm pretty good, but around the corners, I've had to work really hard to be good. Mm-hmm. And I I identified that problem quite a long time ago, but I didn't know how to address it. And that's, and it's been really interesting to break down the problem of cornering and, you know, understand the different terrains, the different cambers, the different, when you're in a rut, when you're not in a rut, how tight the corner is, whether you take your foot off the pedal, whether the pedals are parallel or whether you're dropping the outside foot. All of these things are the problem. And, you know, I find it fascinating trying to understand and get to the bottom of it and to try and attack a racetrack and attack a section as best as possible. And I'd love to be involved with Nico and, you know, discuss these sorts of elements with him.
Cool. Yeah, that would be a fun session. I'd be up for that.
Yeah.
Good stuff. So we're at the end of our time, but I'm just wondering if you've got any recommended reading for our audience. Is there any, are there any books out there that you'd recommend people have a go at?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I've got a ton of books, to be honest. I've got unfortunately, I'm not in front of the shelf because my wife works from home and she's downstairs in the office. And my shelf of books is there. And unfortunately, her job is far more taxing than mine. She edits a scientific journal, so I don't dare disturb her.
Right, fair enough.
Yeah, it's essentially, I would, there's one, if you're interested in improving your strength, I think Starting Strength is a fantastic book. I think Mark Ripito's work is really interesting. I think, let me have a think on some of the, Asker Jürgentrup is a really interesting guy. He's a nutritionist and a physiologist. He used to be my lecturer back at university, and he's gone on to do big things working for GSK now. And he's working for Gatorade now, excuse me. And has, in terms of physiology, is really interesting. And for me, it just, there may be a bit heavy going, but I think that try to understand the problem that you're trying to solve. And, and these books are really good at breaking things down and basic, Starting Strength, that's a fantastic way to actually address becoming stronger, because a lot of people want to become stronger, but they don't really know how to go about it. And they'll be on Instagram or they'll be trying to do the same exercise and not understanding how percentages come into it, rep ranges come into it. So this book's a really good thing. And it's made for people who might only have 2 days a week to train, who might only, you know, it's not made for elite professional athletes. It's for people who are into their strength training. So if if that's you, then I would recommend it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good. I'll make sure I dig a link out and I'll put that in the show notes so people can find it.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. That'd be good.
Cool. Good stuff. And if people want to find out a bit more about yourself, what's the best place for them to find you on the internet?
Probably Instagram. I think I've started to use Instagram more recently, and I think it's a good way of sort of showcasing what I do, for want of a better word, so you can get a bit of an insight into the areas that I work in and who I work with. And I try and put up, I try and use it for some form of education. I'm not one of these guys that puts a million videos up there, but I think that hopefully I can show you what I do. And if you're interested, I'd be really interested to, you know, follow up with anyone who's got any questions or any queries or any issues. And it's just at Alan Milway on Instagram. And I've also got a Facebook page as well. So
cool. Good stuff. And we'll stick that in the show notes as well, so people can find that nice and easily.
Thank you very much.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on. Really enjoyed chatting. And hope the rest of the season with all your athletes goes well.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for your time.
Nice one. Cheers, Alan.
All right. Bye.
All right. That's it for our episode with Alan Milway. If you enjoyed it, head over to iTunes and leave us a review. All right, we've got another episode coming up for you on the 31st of July with Rob Copeland. Rob was the sports psychologist who worked with Steve Peat and Josh Briceland and helped them get to the success they did in their careers. Super interesting one. Don't miss it. Make sure you subscribe. Get stuck in. Also, remember, if you've got questions for Alan, you can ask him over on our Facebook group. So just head to Facebook, search for MTB Performance Tips and Tricks and request to join the group there. All right, until next time. Get out and ride.